And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 28th of June. June 28th is National Tapioca Day. Tapioca is a starch extracted from the cassava root. Cassava, also called yuca, is a tuberous root vegetable native to Brazil, but is now spread as far as West Africa and Southeast Asia. The word tapioca comes from the Tupi language spoken by natives when the Portuguese first arrived in Brazil around 1500. This Tupi word is translated as coagulant and refers to the curd-like starch sediment that is obtained in the extraction process. To make tapioca, cassava root is ground into a pulp. Liquid starch is extracted from the ground cassava and dried into a starchy powder. Tapioca pearls, commonly known as boba, are formed when the tapioca starch is mixed with water to form a dough, which is then shaped into small balls. These balls are cooked until they develop a chewy texture. Starch is a basic source of energy that powers cells of the body and is typically digested quickly. Tapioca is a staple food for millions of people in tropical countries. Some of the most common variations for tapioca include bubble tea, a popular drink in Thailand, and tapioca flatbreads and crackers, which are typical in Indonesia. It's the birthday of John Wesley, born on this day in 1703. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, promoted a vegetarian diet. He felt good physical and spiritual health went together. He also believed that vegetarianism was the diet most compatible with Christian values like mercy, compassion, and kindness. He was against any and all cruelty to animals or causing their suffering by killing them for food. John Wesley said, "I believe in my heart that faith in Jesus Christ can and will lead us beyond an exclusive concern for the well-being of other human beings to the broader concern for the well-being of the birds in our backyards, the fish in our rivers, and every living creature on the face of the earth." It's the birthday of Chris DeRose, born on this day in 1948. Chris DeRose founded Last Chance for Animals, an international nonprofit animal advocacy organization focused on investigating, exposing, and ending animal exploitation. Chris grew up without a father and was put into an orphanage three separate times by his ailing mother. Between the ages of 5 to 8, Chris lived in the orphanage for months at a time. All three times, he never knew if his mother would come back for him. When Chris was in acting school in Hollywood in the late 70s, a dog walked in off the street and sat right at Chris's feet. Chris took the dog home, fed him, and took him to the pound the following morning. As Chris was leaving the dog at the pound, he recognized the look of longing and desperation in the dog's eyes. Chris realized animals have feelings and returned to the pound the next day to get the dog. He learned that the dog's parents had been overjoyed to find him at the pound and had taken him home. The experience left Chris a changed man. Chris had a promising future as an actor, a profession he eventually turned his back on. Instead, he devoted 100% of his time to saving animals and educating people about animal abuse. For 10 years, using the power of the media, he worked as a reporter and special correspondent on Inside Edition, When Animals Attack, 48 Hours, A Current Affair, and Hard Copy. Chris contributed to more than 100 animal stories on these national shows that reached hundreds of millions of people. And here's a reading from one of John Wesley's favorite scripture passages, 1 Corinthians 13. "If I speak with human eloquence and angelic ecstasy, but don't love, I'm nothing but the creaking of a rusty gate. If I speak God's word with power, revealing all the mysteries and making everything plain as day, and if I have faith that says to a mountain, 'Jump,' and it jumps, but I don't love, I'm nothing. If I give everything I own to the poor and even go to the stake to be burned as a martyr, but I don't love, I've gotten nowhere. So no matter what I say, what I believe, and what I do, I'm bankrupt without love. Love never gives up. Love cares more for others than for self. Love doesn't want what it doesn't have. Love doesn't strut, doesn't have a swelled head, doesn't force itself on others, isn't always me first, doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't keep score of the sins of others, doesn't revel when others grovel, takes pleasure in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God always. Always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. Love never dies. Inspired speech will be over someday. Praying in tongues will end. Understanding will reach its limit. We know only a portion of the truth, and what we say about God is always incomplete. But when the complete arrives, our incompletes will be canceled. But for right now, until that completeness, we have three things to do to lead us toward that consummation. Trust steadily in God. Hope unswervingly. Love extravagantly. And the best of the three is love. 1 Corinthians 13. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with a reminder that vegan means love for all. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. Some good news for us today. Here's a story published recently in the Bozeman Chronicle titled Yoga Prodigy Turned Chef Opens Bozeman's Only Vegan Food Truck. Tabay Atkins is set to open Bozeman's only vegan eatery, but converting carnivores isn't his goal. I'm mostly catering to non-vegans, Atkins said. I want to give them options they can choose over a meat-based meal. Most of the time, they enjoy it more than the meat-based original, and they come back as regulars. They don't always decide to go vegan, but at least they now have a new choice. Tabay's Mindful Kitchen opens July 1st in the parking lot of Pure Dispensary at 7th Avenue and Mendenhall. The food truck is fully vegan and national park themed, with comfort classics and fast food favorites all given national park inspired names. While the truck has no official partnership or affiliation with the National Park Service, it offers an immersive experience, including a custom Tabay's Mindful Kitchen stamp for customers' National Parks passport and oval park-style stickers for purchase. Coming to the truck should feel like coming to your favorite national park, Atkins said. Before moving to Bozeman at the end of last year, Atkins lived in and operated his food truck out of Southern California and then Hawaii. There, he recalled several head-turning moments from customers happily eating his burgers and sandwiches without realizing that they weren't eating meat. It's not the first time the 21-year-old chef has turned heads. Help people heal. Before finishing elementary school, Atkins became the world's youngest certified yoga teacher. The same path that led him to yoga and later veganism started with his mother's diagnosis of stage 3 Hodgkin's lymphoma. She was diagnosed when Atkins was 6 years old and already had 2 softball-sized tumors on her neck. The recovery, Atkins said, was nearly as grueling. She had to do very intensive chemotherapy, which broke her down physically and emotionally, to the point where she couldn't even walk on her own, Atkins said. This is before we knew anything about yoga or veganism. Before her recovery, the tumors had made it impossible for her to eat, drink, breathe, or speak comfortably. After undergoing chemotherapy and beating cancer in 2012, she couldn't walk. At that time, yoga wasn't part of mainstream wellness culture like it is today, but Atkins' mother, Sahel Anvarinajad, decided to give the practice a try anyway and found it to be the most effective treatment for the lingering effects of cancer and recovery. She eventually completed her own yoga teacher training with then 7-year-old Atkins by her side. Just a few months into her training, Atkins said he noticed his mother not only walking on her own again, but happier and healthier than she'd ever been before cancer. I didn't think he was paying attention during my training, Ann Varinajed said. Of course, I know kids absorb things that they're hearing, but I was still shocked for him to have paid that close attention and to know what he wanted to do with that experience at such a young age. When Atkins told his mother his dreams of also becoming a yoga teacher, she thought he was sharing what he wanted to be when he grew up. Turns out he wanted to start right away. I was really inspired by how much it helped her heal, Atkins said. It made me want to teach yoga and help other people heal and stay healthy. At 10 years old, he completed his own 200-hour yoga teacher certification with an instructor who did not cut him any slack based on his age. She didn't go easy on me just because I was a kid, Atkins said. I was treated just the same as the other adults in the training, and it was intense for all of us. Atkins' father, retired NFL linebacker Larry Atkins, said he and his wife always knew their son was advanced, but when he finished his certification, they didn't know he had just become the youngest yoga teacher in the world until reporters started reaching out. It was all of a sudden, Ann Varinajed said. Thousands of emails from everywhere around the world wanting him to come be on their TV shows or to teach at their events. It was a huge thing and just blew up from there. To seize the new wave of opportunities, Atkins withdrew from public school and enrolled in homeschool, where he completed online coursework. When his appearances began earning money, Ann Varinajed expected him to buy the toys and treats every 10-year-old dreams of. Instead, Atkins chose to donate it to cancer research. I asked him, well, what are you going to do with the money you're making? Go buy Lego sets or toys? He was like, no, all of this is to help people with cancer, Ann Varinajed said. We took something very bad that happened to me and made something so positive out of it. Being immersed in the world of yoga, Atkins said, made exposure to veganism almost inevitable, since the two share a core value, do no harm. It was on my radar, Atkins said. Eventually, I said, you know what, I'll go vegan. But not right now. I'll go vegan sometime down the line. That vague future time came up sooner than expected. At 12 years old, Atkins watched the 2017 documentary, What the Health, which argues that eating meat, eggs, and dairy significantly raises the risk of cancer and other chronic diseases. Still impacted by his mother's cancer journey, Atkins skipped asking permission and simply informed his parents he decided to go vegan. I was nervous, Ann Varinajed said. The main holdback for us was family and society saying, if you're vegan, you're going to miss out on your nutrition. They were wrong. As a Cordon Bleu trained chef, Ann Varinajed took it on as a challenge, inspired to make vegan food just as good as the nostalgic meals from her own childhood. You're more creative, Ann Varinajed said. I remember I made fried chicken from mushrooms, and it tasted like what I would get when I used to go to KFC, which was often as a kid. After graduating high school at 14, Atkins earned a certification from Cornell University in plant-based nutrition. Before launching the food truck, he began offering nutrition services and meal deliveries tailored to clients' individual health needs. When he launched his food truck 2 years later, Atkins' goals had shifted. His menu is 100% vegan, but that doesn't mean it's health food. By serving dishes indistinguishable from their meat-based inspirations, Atkins isn't trying to sway people into a fully plant-based diet, but every vegan meal a customer buys from him, he said, is one less meat-based meal they're getting elsewhere. I don't say to someone who's not vegan that they should change overnight to whole food, plant-based, no oil, no sugar, nothing processed. A big switch like that can be scary, and I wouldn't recommend it for anyone. Atkins said, I think it should be a progression. It was for us. Atkins and Verinaged carried the values of yoga and veganism into how they ran the food truck itself. The busiest days of the year were Thanksgiving and Christmas, when they stayed open all day and offered a special menu of holiday classics. It was pay what you can, Atkins said. Everyone should have a Thanksgiving meal and a community to enjoy it with. They're also loose about hours of operation. Though the truck was supposed to close at 8 p.m., the two said they always stayed open until there were no customers left to feed, something Anne Verinaged attributed to her Persian culture. We would be up until 11 o'clock or midnight sometimes, just people coming through, and if we hadn't finished cleaning up yet, we'd still make them something, Anne Verinaged said. That's actually saved my life when we had the fire. More than a decade after beating cancer, the family faced another shocking upheaval in 2025. Atkins had recently moved out of his parents' house for the first time to attend Arizona State University, while Anne Verinaged was still in Hawaii running the food truck. One night in February, she was cleaning up and getting ready to close when a young couple came to the window to order soft serve. The ice cream machine, she said, takes an hour to set up and is the one exception to the truck's loose closing hours. I would never make ice cream at 9 o'clock at night, even at 5 p.m. I won't do it until the next morning because it's such a long process, Anne Verinaged said. It was already 8 o'clock, but I saw that they wanted to be there on their date, and I just thought, that's so cute. I'm just going to stay open and do it for them. If she hadn't stayed late to make soft serve for the couple, Anne Verinaged would have already been asleep at home when the fire broke out just before 10 p.m., I don't know what would have happened, Anne Verinaged said, because that fire started right underneath my bedroom. It took months before she could talk about it without getting emotional. Before the fire burned their entire home to the ground, the food truck had been her happy place, from the cooking to the customers. Afterward, in the midst of the emotional weight and finding a new place to live, that feeling became impossible to reclaim. Atkins left school and moved back to Hawaii to help his mother take over running the food truck. 6 months later, he said, things were starting to feel somewhat normal again, and his parents and grandparents headed back to the mainland for his 20th birthday, carrying on a four-year tradition of spending his birthday at a new national park each year. We had never been to Glacier before and heard it's beautiful, Atkins said. It was around this time that I was already thinking, it's time I go back to school. Having visited many other national parks and worked as an intern at Petrified Forest National Park in Arizona, Atkins already had his eye on paleontology as a major. During the family's trip to Glacier, he got to chatting with a park ranger about the subject, who recommended he visit the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman. After checking out the museum, Atkins returned to the family's RV where his grandmother was waiting with a souvenir t-shirt from the gift shop. But the shirt didn't have the museum's logo. Instead, it had the mascot for the Montana State Bobcats. She thought that was the museum's shirt. She didn't know, Atkins said, but it was a nice, soft $25 shirt and it was a kind gift, so I kept it. For the rest of the road trip, I was using it as my PJ top or an eye cover. By the end of the trip, Atkins was narrowing down college choices. Still unsure of his academic path, he was looking for a university that offered majors in both business and paleontology. I was doing my research and weighing my options, and I said, well, I have this t-shirt, Atkins said. Just for the heck of it, let's see what MSU has to offer. He was surprised to find that MSU not only offered majors in his areas of interest, but had one of the best paleontology programs in the country. Now he's set to start classes there this fall, all thanks to a ripple effect that began with a road trip after the house fire and a souvenir from his grandmother that at the time didn't seem to make sense. There are the very specific minor things that you don't even think about, but if you changed any of them in the slightest way, it would change the whole course of your life, Atkins said. I call it the t-shirt effect. By 21, Atkins has been a yoga teacher, a vegan chef, and a food truck owner, none of it the result of a plan he set out to follow. This fall, he's adding college student to the list, balancing his first year at MSU with a food truck opening July 1st, both in a city he found by accident. cannot wait to go to Tabay's Mindful Kitchen food truck on 7th Avenue at the dispensary. Hopefully I'll see you there. Let's finish the second chapter of Frank Oski, MD's book, Don't Drink Your Milk, Frightening Medical Facts About the World's Most Overrated Nutrient. If you listened to our last episode, you know that we left off with Mrs. Edwards, who stopped drinking milk and had her symptoms of abdominal cramps, bloating, and gas disappear. Oski writes, Mrs. Edwards' story is not unusual. Milk consumption does produce gastrointestinal complaints. The majority of people in the world over 4 years old are, in fact, lactose intolerant. You may ask, what is lactose intolerance and what is its relationship to cow's milk? Lactose is the sugar in milk. It is the only sugar, also termed carbohydrate, present in milk. Lactose is a disaccharide, meaning that it is made up of two simple sugars. Glucose and galactose are the two monosaccharides that link together form the disaccharide lactose. This sugar is formed by the cells of the lactating mammary gland. No other food except mammalian milk contains lactose. The only mammals that do not have lactose or any other carbohydrate in their milk are seals, sea lions, and walruses. Human milk contains about 75 grams of lactose per quart, while cow's milk contains close to 45 grams per quart. When consumed in milk, lactose, the disaccharide, must be broken down into its two monosaccharides before it can be absorbed from the intestinal tract into the bloodstream. Lactase is the enzyme that breaks down the lactose in milk and milk products. Lactase is present in the intestinal cells of the upper part of the gastrointestinal tract, and its highest concentration is in that portion of the small bowel called the jejunum. Lactase activity first appears in the intestinal tract of infants during the last trimester of pregnancy and is at its height shortly after birth. If the amount of lactose in the diet exceeds the capacity of the lactase in the intestine to break it down, then the lactose is undigested and proceeds to the large intestine. When the undigested lactose reaches the colon or large intestine, two things happen. First, the lactose is acted upon by the bacteria that normally inhabit the colon. They ferment the lactose and convert it to gas, carbon dioxide, and to an acid, lactic acid. The lactose molecules also cause water to be drawn into the intestinal tract by a process of osmosis. As a result, more gas and water are present in the colon. This combination produces a sense of bloating and also results in belching, the passage of gas from the rectum, cramps, and on occasion, watery diarrhea. Prior to 1965, it was assumed that the absence of lactase in the intestinal tract was an unusual disorder seen in some infants as a result of a hereditary abnormality or in association with other diseases of the intestinal tract. It was in that year that investigators at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine first observed that 15% of all whites and 70% of all blacks tested were unable to digest lactose. Surveys of the world populations were begun, and we now know that far more people are unable to digest lactose than are able to digest it. Sometime between the age of 1.5 and 4 years, most individuals gradually lose the lactase activity in their small intestine. This appears to be a normal process that accompanies maturation. It occurs in most mammals shortly after they are weaned. Humans behave just like other animals in this regard. To give you some appreciation of how common lactase deficiency is, following are some statistics regarding the prevalence of lactase deficiency based on healthy adults from various worldwide population groups. The Bantus are 90% lactose intolerant. The Thais, 90% lactose intolerant. Filipinos, 90%. Greek Cypriots, 85%. Japanese, 85%. Taiwanese, 85%. Greenland Eskimos, 80%. Arabs, 78%. Ashkenazic Jews, 78%. Peruvians, 70%. American Blacks, 70%. Israeli Jews, 58%. Indians, 50%. Finns, 18%. American Whites, 8%. Swiss, 7%. And Danes, 2%. Dr. Norman Kretschmer, former director of the Institute of Child Health and Human Development of the National Institutes of Health, several years ago analyzed the distribution of lactase deficiency in Nigeria. He studied four of the major tribal groups of that country, the Yoruba, Igbo, Hausa, and Fulani. The Yoruba and Igbo live in an area of the country where there is no cattle raising and where almost no milk is consumed after weaning. In these groups, 99% of the population was lactase deficient between 1.5 and 3 years of age. The Hausa and Fulani live in the north of Nigeria, where cattle raising and ingestion of milk and milk products is traditional. Among the nomadic dairy herders of the Fulani tribe who live chiefly on milk and milk products, the incidence of lactase deficiency was only 20%. Dr. Kretschmer concluded from these observations that the ability to absorb lactose was genetically determined and that a process of natural selection was responsible for the fact that tribes who must live from milk in order to survive developed a high incidence of mutant individuals who retain the presence of the enzyme lactase. It is natural to lose the lactase activity in the gastrointestinal tract. It is a biological accompaniment of growing up. Most people do it. All animals do it. It reflects the fact that nature never intended lactose-containing foods, such as milk, to be consumed after the normal weaning period. If loss of the enzyme lactase is the usual pattern of development, then those individuals who retain the capacity to digest the sugar after infancy might, in American slang, be called milk freaks. Prior to the recognition of lactase deficiency, the problems created by the shipment of powdered milk to the developing countries of the world were a source of puzzlement and frustration to U.S. government officials. Stories are now legend about what happened after initial shipments of powdered milk arrived in some South American countries. The natives carefully followed instructions concerning the reconstitution of the powdered milk with water. However, after the product became palatable and was drunk, widespread outbreaks of cramps and diarrhea were experienced in the villages. Reaction was strong and widespread. Another ingenious imperialist plot. When subsequent shipments of powdered milk were received, the natives mixed them with far less water and then used it to whitewash their huts. Some American scientists believe that the U.S. dairy industry has been attempting to whitewash the entire lactase deficiency problem ever since. Unfortunately, cow's milk is still a staple of the government-sponsored school lunch programs. These programs are primarily supposed to benefit children in inner-city schools and are designed to provide students with at least one good meal per day. Most of these children in the major cities are Black. A group of Johns Hopkins investigators observed the milk-drinking habits of 300 Black and 200 white children in Baltimore schools. At lunch, each child was given a half pint of milk. The majority of the blacks consumed less than half their milk, with most drinking less than one-fourth. In contrast, only 10% of the whites failed to drink at least half their milk. When the latter children were tested for their ability to digest lactose, it was found that among all white children, 18% were unable to digest lactose, while 33% of the black milk drinkers had abnormal tests, and 77% of the non-milk drinkers had abnormal tests. When the black children who were non-milk drinkers were given lactose as a test, 85% of them developed symptoms of cramping, pain, gas, or diarrhea. These investigators concluded that lactose intolerance was a major factor in milk rejection among black children. Although these children had learned that milk drinking would lead to unpleasant consequences for them, the U.S. government still acted as if it was unaware of the problem. Milk not only continued to be a key staple in these government-subsidized lunch programs, but even worse, additional funds were allocated and spent in 1976 for food supplement programs. In these programs, stamps could only be used for a limited number of foods, including milk. The fact that many individuals are lactose intolerant helps to explain what was once believed to be a cultural myth concerning the healing properties of yogurt and cheese. When milk is made into yogurt by incubating it with a bacterial stock, much of the lactose is broken down into glucose and galactose. Similarly, when cheese ripens, much of the lactose is also converted to simple sugars. These substances can now be tolerated by individuals who would be otherwise intolerant of whole milk. The old expression that cheese or yogurt was binding probably reflects the fact that when lactase-deficient individuals switched to these products, they noticed that their stools became firmer. Yogurt is frequently administered to infants with diarrhea. During the course of diarrhea, many infants will experience a transient lactase deficiency. When this occurs, the continual administration of milk only aggravates the gastrointestinal upset. Because this phenomenon is so common, American manufacturers of baby formulas have produced lactose-free milks to be used when feeding is resumed in infants afflicted with diarrhea. The dairy industry has openly criticized the findings of the lactose tolerance tests. Spokesmen contend that the amounts of lactose administered in the tests are unusually large and thus have no bearing on what might be expected to occur with more normal milk consumption. While it is true that lactose intolerance should not be equated with milk intolerance, tests have demonstrated that as many as 60 to 75% of individuals judged to be lactase deficient by conventional testing will experience gastrointestinal upsets after the consumption of one standard 8-ounce glass of milk. These symptoms may be reduced by drinking milk with a lower lactose content or by taking the milk with a meal. Americans in recent years have complained bitterly about the rising cost of gasoline. However, when the lactase-deficient individual buys whole milk, he is paying a premium for his intestinal gas. Studies have suggested that some of the nutritional benefits of milk may be lost when a lactase-deficient individual consumes milk. Not only does this person fail to receive the calories normally supplied by the undigested carbohydrates, but resultant diarrhea may also lead to a loss of protein as well. Belly aches in children are quite common. It has been estimated that as many as one child in 10 may experience the syndrome termed recurrent abdominal pain of childhood. It is usually seen in children of school age, occurs over a period of months, and is often worse in the mornings. However, in almost all instances, no evidence of disease can be found. Two studies were conducted in groups of children with recurrent abdominal pain of childhood. One study was performed in Boston and the other in San Francisco. Both studies came to a similar conclusion. The conclusion was that about one-third of such children had their symptoms on the basis of lactose intolerance. The simple solution was to remove all milk and milk-containing foods from the diet and watch for signs of improvement. And that was chapter 2 of Dr. Frank Oskey's book, Don't Drink Your Milk. That chapter was titled Paying Premium for a Quart of Intestinal Gas. We'll read chapter 3 next time. And here's a story that was published in Sentient Media titled The Meat Industry is Funding Studies That Claim Meat is Good for You. A whopping 75% of studies with meat industry funding reported favorable nutritional results associated with eating meat. Is meat good for you? It's been the subject of heated debate for decades. Countless studies have attempted to determine the effects of meat on the human body, and they've largely come to the same conclusion. Eating too much red and ultra-processed meat is unhealthy. Specifically, it leads to higher risks of cancer, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. But sometimes meat studies are carried out not by independent parties, but by researchers who have connections to or funding from the meat industry itself. And wouldn't you know it, these industry-affiliated studies are 16 times more likely to conclude that meat actually isn't all that bad for you. That's what a recent meta-analysis in the journal Obesity Reviews found. Researchers looked at 500 studies on the health impacts of meat consumption published between 2014 and 2023, around 15% of which were funded by or conducted by researchers with connections to the meat industry. The search criteria the researchers used focused mostly on red meat, specifically meat from cows, pigs, and sheep. Before diving into the results at length, it's worth noting that none of the studies were directly connected to individual meat companies themselves. Rather, they were associated with or funded by initiatives like the American Beef and Pork Checkoff Programs, government-run, taxpayer-funded initiatives aimed at increasing the public's consumption of meat products and supporting American meat producers or industry trade associations like the Australian Meat and Livestock Association. Ultimately, 61% of independently funded studies concluded that eating meat in some quantity or another is correlated with negative health outcomes, and 28% reached neutral or mixed conclusions. By contrast, only one single industry-funded study linked negative health outcomes to eating meat, and a whopping 75% of the studies with meat industry funding reported favorable nutritional outcomes associated with meat consumption. In total, industry-affiliated studies were 16 times more likely than the rest to report favorable conclusions regarding meat's health impacts. While it may not be surprising to learn that conflicts of interest can skew the results of a study, it's worth taking a closer look at how this skewing actually works, as it's not quite as straightforward as it may seem. Using something called the Mixed Methods Appraisal Tool, the researchers behind this meta-analysis assessed and compared how well the studies were designed from a scientific perspective. The goal was to determine whether the industry-affiliated studies were less methodologically sound than the others, and as it turns out, they were. Studies with industry ties scored an average of 61% on the assessment, while studies without any ties scored an average of 80%, indicating a higher level of methodological rigor. However, that's not the end of the story. While 61% isn't great, it's also not terrible and doesn't indicate that the study is complete garbage or should be disregarded. Moreover, the researchers behind the meta-analysis accounted for the lower scores in their analysis and concluded that while industry studies may differ in methodological quality, this does not sufficiently explain the large differences in their conclusions compared to independent studies. What this means is that the skew towards positive outcomes in meat industry-associated research is not necessarily related to the scientific rigor of these studies, the meta-analysis says. But if scientific rigor doesn't explain the difference, what does? While the authors say that more research is needed to definitively answer this question, they did cite three factors that may account for the differences: choice of study design, selective reporting, and the framing or interpretation of the results. Choice of study design simply refers to what type of study is being conducted and what specifically is being studied. Research on the health impacts of food typically don't seek to answer broad sweeping questions like, is meat good for you? Instead, they focus narrowly on one specific sub-question, such as, does eating red meat two or more times a week increase the risk of colorectal cancer? It's possible that these choices of what to study and how could account for the different conclusions of industry-affiliated studies and independent ones. Selective reporting is a type of bias in which researchers only report some of the findings of their studies, while the use of framing or interpretation refers to the ways in which the findings of a study are described and articulated by the researchers. Most scientific studies have an abstract section at the top that summarizes the findings for the reader, along with a conclusions section at the bottom that sums up the big picture takeaways. These sections offer researchers the opportunity to spin their study's findings to promote one takeaway or another without literally misreporting the findings themselves. Previous research on topics other than meat consumption has shown that industry ties in research studies can influence conclusions without necessarily influencing results, indicating the use of spin in their reporting and the reporting of less reliable conclusions. The paper reads, "Conclusions are important because they may be picked up by media publications and can influence how research is interpreted. Whatever the reason for this discrepancy, the upsides for the meat industry are numerous," notes Marion Nessel, Emerita Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. "When a published study claims that a product is good for you, the press picks it up and widely publicizes the benefits of the product. Consumers read their reports and consider the product a health food," Nessel adds. Nessel tells Sentient in an email, "Sales of the product increase. Government agencies and health organizations have to take that research into consideration when formulating dietary guidelines. The Obesity Review study illustrates the importance of looking at the body of research as opposed to one single study before drawing any firm conclusions. When it comes to red and processed meat, the body of research is clear. Eating too much of it is bad for you." And from plant-based news, Kevin Bacon wants you to swap meat for beans one day per week. Award-winning actor Kevin Bacon is backing Humane World for Animals' new meat-free Beans Day. Kevin Bacon has suggested swapping meat for beans on a Wednesday to improve your health, harm fewer animals, and protect the planet. In a playful PSA for Humane World for Animals, the actor joked about changing his name to Kevin Bean in recognition of Beans Day. Humane World for Animals launched Beans Day earlier this week as a meat-free Monday-style way for people to reduce their consumption of animal products. "You know me as Kevin Bacon, but on Wednesdays, I'm Kevin Bean, because Wednesday is Beans Day, the day we swap meat for beans. They're packed with protein and fiber. They keep you full longer. You save money and animals. They're just beans until you realize how many animals they spare," Bacon said in the PSA. Observing Beans Day is a small step that makes a big difference. Take it from me, Kevin Bean. To support Beans Day participants, Humane World for Animals has launched a new hub that includes a pledge and recipes from plant-based chefs and food influencers. In the first 24 hours, well over 12,000 people pledged meat-free Beans Day meals. Over the years, I've developed a deep connection with animals. You get to know them as individuals, and it makes you reflect deeply about the food choices you make, Bacon said. That's why I loved the idea of Beans Day. One simple change in what you eat every Wednesday makes a difference for animals. And if becoming Kevin Bean for a little while helps get people involved, I'm all in. Animal agriculture uses approximately 83% of farmland, but provides just 37% of humanity's protein and 18% of its calories. Overconsumption of animal products is also linked with myriad health issues. Meanwhile, beans are cheap, culturally accessible, versatile, sustainable, and nutritious. They contain protein, potassium, magnesium, iron, and zinc with no cholesterol, little fat, and plenty of fiber. A single portion of beans notably contains 100% more fiber than a chicken breast. In May, a report by the Protein Project predicted that fava bean consumption could double by 2040, leading to an increased share of beans for human consumption and a saving of 42 million pounds in healthcare costs and 27 million pounds in fertilizer imports. And here is a story from Sentient Media, entitled, "This Key Tool Could Protect Whales and Dolphins Worldwide. Advocates Want the U.S. to Use It." Stronger enforcement of U.S. import law could spare marine mammals from deadly fishing gear around the world, advocates say. You might think that the greatest threat to whales, dolphins, and seals worldwide would be climate change or perhaps whaling and other deliberate hunting of the animals. But their biggest threat is actually bycatch, when they are accidentally caught or hurt by commercial fishing operations that are trying to catch fish and other seafood. Each year, more than 650,000 marine mammals are killed as bycatch worldwide, scientists estimate. Now, in a new tactic to fight this, conservation and animal welfare organizations are suing the U.S. government in an effort to halt seafood imports from 8 countries whose fisheries allegedly entangle and kill large numbers of whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals. The plaintiffs, Center for Biological Diversity, Natural Resources Defense Council, or the NRDC, and Animal Welfare Institute, AWI, argue that federal regulators are failing to enforce the existing Marine Mammal Protection Act, which requires the U.S. government to ban seafood imports from foreign fisheries that harm or kill marine mammals beyond limits allowed under U.S. law. The lawsuit filed in the U.S. Court of International Trade challenges the authorization of seafood imports from Argentina, Ecuador, India, Norway, Taiwan, Tunisia, the United Kingdom, and Vanuatu, where commercial fishing practices are accused of killing marine mammals at levels that exceed U.S. standards. American fishers invest in monitoring, gear modification, and bycatch reduction to meet those standards, Zach Smith, Director of Global Biodiversity Conservation at the NRDC, tells Sentient in an email. Foreign fisheries selling into the same market should meet the same bar. The U.S. imports nearly 90% of its seafood supply. A spokesperson for the National Marine Fisheries Services, also known as NOAA Fisheries, says the agency cannot comment on matters of litigation. NOAA Fisheries, the primary agency responsible for managing and protecting whales, dolphins, seals, and sea lions under the law, is a defendant in the case. Multiple fishing methods contribute to the more than 650,000 marine mammals killed as bycatch each year. The animals often drown or are caught and then discarded at sea. Fishing methods such as longlining, trawling, and the use of gill nets are among the practices most commonly associated with bycatch. The vaquita, a porpoise species found only in the northern Gulf of California, has been pushed to the brink of extinction, largely because it becomes entangled and drowns in gill nets. Considered the world's most endangered cetacean, the species is estimated to number as few as 10 individuals. To address the issue of bycatch, the Marine Mammal Protection Act requires the U.S. government to reduce the number of marine mammals seriously injured or killed in this way to nearly zero. In 2016, this mandate was extended to international trade. The United States must block seafood imports from any country whose fisheries injure or kill marine mammals at higher rates than allowed domestically. Foreign nations must provide evidence that their standards match those of the United States. In September 2025, NOAA Fisheries declared that about two-thirds of 135 countries met those comparability standards for all of their export fisheries. Meanwhile, about a quarter of countries had some fisheries that did not meet U.S. standards, and in 7% of countries, no fisheries met U.S. standards. Fisheries that receive positive comparability findings are allowed to export seafood to the U.S., while those who fail to meet the standards face import restrictions. But after reviewing NOAA Fisheries findings, the conservation animal welfare groups argue that some approved fisheries do not, in fact, comply with the law. They allege that findings for the 8 countries named in the lawsuit are based on incorrect assumptions, flawed and inadequate evidence, and other logical and factual errors. Those fisheries don't actually meet the high bar that the MMPA sets, and NOAA Fisheries is thus unlawfully authorizing imports from fisheries that catch and kill marine mammals in excess of U.S. standards. Georgia Hancock, director of the Marine Wildlife Program and senior attorney at the Animal Welfare Institute, tells Sentient in an email. The plaintiffs allege that fisheries in Argentina kill Franciscana river dolphins at rates that contribute to population declines, and that Vanuatu's tuna fishery does not use the special hooks required for American fishers to reduce the bycatch of false killer whales. In Norway, meanwhile, the groups allege that gray seals and harbor porpoises are dying at levels that exceed U.S. standards. The groups cite assessments showing that in the U.K., the accidental capture of porpoises and common dolphins is happening at unsustainable levels, and that entanglements could harm small populations of North Atlantic humpback whales. Meanwhile, they allege that bycatch from Taiwan fisheries threatens the critically endangered Taiwanese humpback dolphin, vulnerable Indo-Pacific finless porpoise, and near-threatened Indo-Pacific bottlenose dolphins. Meanwhile, the plaintiffs also claim that bycatch estimates in Ecuador, India, and Tunisia are not reliable because some fisheries lack the necessary monitoring systems. Andrew Reed, a biologist at Duke University studying marine mammals, says that the approach of imposing trade restrictions poses an important question. Can the actions of a single state impose conservation standards on other states? Because the United States is the world's largest seafood importer by value, Smith says, its economic leverage is effective at forcing international policy changes. It's worked before. He notes that after the United States threatened to ban seafood exports from countries that did not meet its standards, multiple countries took steps to clean up their acts. Grenada implemented new bycatch reporting requirements. Ireland committed to banning the killing of seals, and New Caledonia passed a legislation outlawing the intentional killing of mammals. These three countries are now allowed to export their seafood to the United States. U.S. regulations against dolphin bycatch in tuna nets and sea turtle bycatch in shrimp trawls were also upheld in the World Trade Organization, Reed notes. Simple changes in fishing practices, such as lowering drift nets below the surface, as well as technologies like acoustic alarms attached to fishing nets, can reduce bycatch, according to Reed. Consumers and retailers also play a vital role. By demanding transparent, consistent, and trustworthy seafood certification labels and making information on catch locations and gear types readily accessible to the public, writes Hancock of Animal Welfare Institute. But she points out that the most effective action is eating less seafood and replacing it with plant-based options. We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.